This episode of The Drunken Odyssey is brought to you by Scribophile, an online community with thousands of serious writers working in every conceivable genre. If you're eager to improve your own work and network with others, Scribophile is for you. Scribophile has educational tutorials, exciting forums, and most importantly, the ability to exchange in-depth critiques with other writers, using a karma system that keeps the exchange fair and equal. What is most exciting to me is that Scribophile allows writers to critique novel chapters, which is not something a writer can be guaranteed to experience in an MFA program. A basic account is free and grants you all the features, but upgrading to a premium account allows you to gain access to posting numerous works at once, requires no additional karma points to enter contests and other special features for only $9 a month or $65 a year. That's a lot less than a Netflix subscription. Listeners of The Drunken Odyssey will receive a 20% discount on top of those already low rates. Check out this week's show notes for details.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 436 of the World's Greatest Writing Podcast. My guest today is Alex Miller, a creative nonfiction writer whose experiences in life and journalism are pretty amazing. So I've been doing this podcast for 8 years, and I don't know what I'm doing most of the time when it comes to introductions. I share literary news I think is interesting or important, and offer my unique and spiritually uplifting take on the matter, and mention what writing I've done to hold myself accountable in this public way. Which is as often as not a way of leveraging shame to keep me up late at night searching for the next sentence. This time of pandemic has been hard for my concentration and sleep, and the political situation in America has me wired in a way that makes the play of storytelling, let's call it elusive. There once was an angry paperclip named Ebenezer. His highest ambition in life was to win a gold medal as an Olympic ice skater for the Netherlands, a dream thwarted by his living in Ontario and... I mean, this is no judgment of Ebenezer. A dream also thwarted by his being an inanimate object. One day he was taken outside and bent to hold a worm into an icy, watery hole. And as his body quavered left to right, then right to left, he felt the cold contract his skin, and he dreamed and dreamed or hallucinated, vibrating as a dark fish stole him down to the black bottom of the lake. A trophy for evolution to choke on, where no other creature could see. Any of you out there listening who are publishers, that masterpiece is awaiting a home. So I've got two things to try to say in this introduction today. So let me try and say them. I've noticed a lot of Facebook friends, often younger people, but not always, are in some despair about their families who are... virulently faithful to the bad faith of Donald Trump and his enablers who seem to prefer racism and mob rule to justice for all and for peace. In the 2012 book, The Republican Brain, journalist Chris Mooney wanted to know why Republicans seem so eager to deny science and evidence and reasonable argument. Republicans tend to demonstrate an authoritarian mindset. Trust authority, especially if it's authority you like. And one of the characteristic traits of authoritarian thinking is that when an authoritarian is challenged in his or her beliefs, with evidence or argument, not only does the authoritarian in question not change his or her position, but the authoritarian holds the view even more forcefully than before. Psychologically, this is like facing off against a hydra. engagement is likely to result in the opposite of what you hope for. If you consider how exponential the cognitive dissonance is for conservatives and Republicans, our president not only do nothing to stop a pandemic from decimating our country, but actually helping the pandemic, our president cooperating with Russia, a country that hacked our election in 2016 and is doing so now, and which put a bounty on U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan, our president calling soldiers who die for our country losers and suckers, many conservatives and Republicans and members of the conspiratorial right are understandably going kind of nuts. I don't have a political strategy for minimizing their influence, but persuasive argument cannot be it. You cannot reason someone out of ideas that he didn't reason himself into. Liberals love to argue and explore evidence and alternative points of view, generally speaking. We should not assume that is where everyone is coming from. The Great Enlightenment, if it ever existed, is over. So if you need to take a break from letting your family antagonize you or vice versa, that might be wise. On a different topic, one of my dear friends died this week. His name was Blake Girard, and he taught at Auburn University, Montgomery. His scholarly focus was the 18th century, in particular the work of the brilliantly strange clergyman, Lawrence Stern, who wrote Tristram Shandy and A Sentimental Journey. I met Blake in the 1990s when I was earning my master's degree at Florida Atlantic University, which has produced, among its illustrious alumni, the top, known as Carrot. I was shredding my mind on James Joyce's Ulysses back then. I thought I wanted to be a Byron scholar when I entered the MA work, which was probably a ruse because actually I really just wanted to be Byron, but I read Ulysses the summer before I entered the MA program, and that was that. As a friend, Blake was smart, honest, funny, and generous, which basically makes him close to being a saint on earth. One I can believe in, anyway. Academic life, like most lives, is absurd, and yet he and I could love it and see how unbearably precious the whole thing could be. Human beings behaving unconsciously like Monty Python characters, arguing a bureaucracy into delusions of grandeur that perhaps betray a sense that time does indeed fly and that there is a real world outside academia. Besides editing the academic journal, The Scriblarian, he also edited That Literary Magazine. That's capital T-H-A-T. From things his students have been saying online about him, he was just as generous to them as he was to his friends, listening and inspiring, and trying to see writers for who they aspired to be, and helping to see that for themselves, and to become that. He was a benevolent star. I don't expect to meet his like again. Let's get to the interview.
And now, the interview of the day.
My guest today, Alex Miller, is an extraordinary creative nonfiction writer whose work has appeared in some of the major journalistic venues, such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, and that incredibly liberal magazine, Forbes. So, Alex, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be talking to you.
You write a lot about the African-American experience, or at least your African-American experience, in a way that's personal, that I find to be humanizing, because when I think of a lot of the issues that are happening today, and they just won't stop happening, Jacob Blake was shot 7 times 2 days ago, I think it was.
Yeah.
And the entire police force of America has to know, you can't be doing this. This is for having a national crisis all around us, and it just can't stop happening. And I find that when I read nonfiction personal essays, that I get to feel things other than just outrage and anger, which I think is helpful for the long road ahead of just trying to figure out what we can do to try and make things better, other than swearing and protesting. It's going to be a long road of protesting, but there needs to be more as well. So I think that's one of the reasons why I find your essay so satisfying. Also, sometimes they're just great, like your essay about getting excited about video games more than women when women break your heart. Can you address a little bit about what attracts you to writing nonfiction in ways that seem to reflect the news without it being directly about the news.
Of course. Thank you. Oh, thank you for appreciating my work, too. You know, but, you know, people don't do that enough. I don't have enough people telling me, you know what?
More of that.
No, I'm really glad, though. I'm happy that I'm able to give perspectives that I think a lot of people don't often run into. I'm happy to write about the nonfiction Black 34-year-old Chicago male perspective. But it took a while for me to get comfortable doing that. A lot of things have changed since I first started writing professionally. I started writing professionally in 2011. It has become necessary for more people of, not just people of color, but people of all colors to delve into the personal essay writing. Because as a nation, we are getting further and further away from relatability. There are so many groups and individuals who want to take it to the extreme. Not like just the QAnon guys, good Lord. Not just those guys, right? But there are other people.
There are less obvious bubbles out there than the QAnon, yeah.
Yeah. There was a point when you kind of understood what was going on, you know? You understood that, okay, well, this is what the news is saying, and then this is what's happening. So I can look at the news, and then I can look at what's actually happening, and then I can try to filter out what is really going on. I think now the idea of truth and truthfulness and fake media, these ideas are no longer clear. There's no longer enough good information and good reporting being done for people to say, okay, the rest of the stuff is ridiculous. This is just nonsense. Don't listen to what Breitbart is saying, or don't look at The Blaze. There are too many people out there who are intentionally distorting what it means to be a journalist, distorting what it means to be what right. good reporting means. So I think that it's so much more important now that individuals give their takes on what's actually happening, because it gives us, especially if they're there at the thing, when the thing happens, giving an honest accounting of an event, using emotions, using all of the skills that you get as a writer. I think it's important that we take a personal essay much more seriously now, because, you know, every time something happens, like I was reading something earlier today or yesterday, I can't remember, but the guy who filmed the attack, he says he's having nightmares. He's like, you know, I can't even believe what I saw, what I filmed. We're not supposed to. This is the police we're talking about. And they're giving justification for shooting a man 7 times in the back while his kids are in the car. Well, that guy should write about that experience. I mean, should. I know he's been interviewed and everything, but I think that on top of giving a detailed look into that experience, it's also therapeutic in a lot of ways to write about really traumatizing things. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good thing that the personal essay is becoming more of a way to connect with people who don't really know what's going on because of conspiracy theorists. I think that's a good thing. Me personally, if I write an article based off of something in the news, my experience in the news, and I get these answers from these responses from people on the internet who just don't know what they're talking about. And they're like, well, you're lying. Racism isn't that bad. black people aren't oppressed. The most oppressed people on the planet are whites. And it's because of affirmative action. And, you know, and like you just go, and it's just like this whole thing. I can show you some conversations that I've had with some of these guys. It always happens, though. Like, it always happens. It always happens. It used to be frustrating to me. Now it's just comical because I'm like, wow, you don't know this? You don't know that racism is still a problem in America? Are you one of them? Maybe that's why. Maybe that's why you don't know. But no, it's a real thing.
Well, I think one of the reasons why nonfiction like this, personal essays, help is because you're not usually trying to make a directly political point in them. So people can, although it sounds like people insist on finding a political point in things. And instead, it's more like, hey, why don't you consider my experience? You know, and a lot of it is anecdotal, but it's also very human. So it's like, should we build policy just on your essays? Well, no, but maybe you should think about what stories we're telling on a grand scale after reading work like yours and other people's work, rather than merely finding out what our tribe believes and then building a rhetoric around that, no matter what evidence we find.
Yeah. Right.
In some ways, it just slows us down. And one of the reasons why perhaps you're dealing with more interesting and complicated traffic is because you're not publishing in small literary magazines or on obscure websites. Your reach is international in scope, which also might be why you don't get as much fan mail as you might prefer, because readers of the New York Times, when they read your piece, they may love it, but it's not like, oh, thank God, another piece by him. And, you know, it may take them a while to connect these dots, that if they just read a bunch of your work, that is going to work really great too. So you're kind of spread around in this global sense.
Yeah, I think what it is just, I was in the same way that so many people were naive about how America hasn't really changed that much since the 60s. In the same way that they were naive about that, I was naive about what to expect in comment sections of pieces. Because, you know what I mean? Yeah. I was naive about that, because you have to wear both shoes. You have to accept that there hasn't been a ton of change since the civil rights movement. But at the same time, you have to be willing to accept there are people who think that there has been a lot of change since the civil rights movement, who are going to negate everything that you say, no matter what, because they think, either, I don't know if they have some kind of evidence somehow, or they just from their own experiences feel that, well, no, things are so much better for you guys now. You guys can do anything you want to now, I guess.
Barack Obama proves there's been no racism since, and it's like...
Exactly. Somebody made that argument. Somebody said, a bunch of people have said, well, look, things aren't so bad. You get a black president, what do you want? And I'm like, Well, I'm pretty sure that people thought racism ended when Jackie Robinson got on the Dodgers, right? Like, he got on the Brooklyn Dodgers, and they're probably like, wow, racism is over. Look, they got a black guy in baseball, in Major League Baseball now. Look at him.
There that was just an uncontested success of racial harmony in our country. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Right.
Didn't he get death letters? I'm sure that didn't happen. Okay.
It's so funny because when he was running, after he won, during his presidency, it was like, oh, well, he's black. Oh, but he's not black enough. You know, so it was always this thing of, wait, what is it? we can only claim half of the White House? Is that what it is? I don't know. I don't know what's going on. I don't know. No,
well, that's part of the problem of having a giant media structure as we do in this country. They have to generate content. So in a single election cycle, we saw, you know, in 2008, is America ready for a black president? And it's like, well, there's only one way to find out, and that's called the election. But then when it seemed like he was doing pretty well in the polls, it's like, oh, is he black enough as president? And it's like... By what fucking metric can any of this make any sense?
The one drop rule, the one drop of black blood, you're black. I don't know. You know, it's this funny thing, though. I think that a lot of black writers and journalists and authors have to consider, how do you approach this issue? How do you approach this issue, whatever the piece is about? Are you going to write as a writer who is black, or are you going to write as a black writer?
Right.
you know? And that's something I've dealt with. I feel like I have intentionally tried to write things that go beyond just race. I think I don't know how great of a job that I've done with that, but I think that what I started out to do was to just be a writer who happens to be Black.
Well, it's this peculiar thing in that.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a cultural difference? Well, sometimes a lot of that just has to do with the invention of race in this country. Like, you know, I was teaching in Brooklyn and I played for my students, David Sedaris's The Sandyland Diaries. And halfway through, he talks about having a crush on a fellow elf at Macy's. And my students were like, hold on, wait, is this a woman? I thought this was a man. It's like, no, it's a man. And they're like, but he didn't warn us he was gay. And I'm like, yes, because he wakes up being gay and it's not something he has to think about. Like, does he have to like frame the essay so that heteronormative people will just feel completely unthreatened or know, like, oh, I had a trigger warning because it comes up twice. And there's no gay sex. It's just he has crushes on guys. Yeah. Once I explained it to the students, like, he wakes up, he's just a dude, and like he doesn't need to frame it as if he's not himself. And they're like, oh, we get it. Okay. All right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And I was like, wow. But not everybody gets that classroom experience where it's like, huh.
Well, it's true. I love Sedaris. I love him to death. He's a master at his craft. I know that a lot of his humor comes from oppression, you know? A lot of his humor comes out of the oppressive nature of, you know, where he's from.
Yeah.
He can't help but be himself. But part of the reason he's himself is because of what he can't help. I don't know. Does that sound right? That doesn't make sense.
Well, you know, at the beginning of his career or before, you know, he was writing essays and appearing on NPR, being gay is something that could get you killed.
Yeah.
And it could still get people killed, but there's just a lot more love and acceptance now for homosexuality. But I think one of the reasons why he started his career the way he did, he had this crazy short story about he's bragging about how he was making his ex-boyfriend, Charlton Heston, jealous by dating Mike Tyson, or maybe it was the other way around, but it was so gay and so bonkers, including gaying up people who were not gay at all, that
anything else
he would write after that, you're like, okay, he cleared the space for that. So then now that he's older and, you know, he's built this, it doesn't come up very often. He just talks about, you know, he talks about Hugh, his partner, and it's really no different than being part of a straight couple.
Yeah, I think that is the kind of writer I try to emulate. Just a writer who's a writer talking about something. Recently, race has been such a big topic in the media, more than most years in recent memory, that I have found myself having to touch on these subjects. The last time I published something was either this month or late last month. I can't remember. But it was about the animosity between Jews and Blacks as it pertained to New York City. It was very controversial because just because of the fact that there are these two cultures, similar in a lot of ways, but also very different in other ways, that used to work a lot more closely together to advance understanding and things such as this, but which have drifted apart a lot since the 60s, we'll say, for instance. And having lived in Brooklyn and seen firsthand my Jewish friends say certain things about the way they were raised, and then my Black friends say a lot of different things about the Jewish community, it was a piece that I wrote that I felt I could really just put myself in between the two. I didn't have to be a Black guy. I could give the Black interpretation of how they respond to Hasidic Jews. And then I could also give the interpretation of my really close friends and my ex-girlfriend and their interpretation of how Blacks respond to them and or how their community specifically felt towards black people. It was a very interesting take for me because I knew that I was writing this in response to something else that happened. Nick Cannon had his show canceled because he had Griff on the show. And if you're a guy with such radical ideas that even Chuck D or Flavor Flav don't want to have you as a member inside of their collective, inside of their own personal space, that says a lot about what it is you're going for. Use divisive languages like with Farrakhan. You got to understand that there's going to be some kind of pushback. There's going to be a reaction to statements like that. And when I was listening to the interview, which ultimately got taken off of YouTube for hate speech reasons.
That's seldom a good look.
Yeah. I was like, you know, you got to understand, you can't have this kind of conversation with any kind of person, right? It's like, okay, so I want to have a conversation about the Holocaust. And I want it to be involved. I want it to be detailed. I want it to be thought-provoking. Let me call Mel Gibson. Let's get him on and let's see what he has to say about the Holocaust. Right. Like, you don't do that. This is not what you do. If you want to have a real conversation, you don't do that. You don't call Mel Gibson or his dad to talk about the Holocaust. Right. Don't do that. There are platforms for that. And then there's still consequences for having that conversation on those platforms. You got to understand what you're doing before you do it, especially when it comes to topics like that, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that when Nick did, he approached the topic using the wrong optics. I mean, first off, you don't start off saying that the Jewish people are a global cabal of puppet masters, right? Like, you know what I mean? That whole idea, that whole conspiracy about the Jews run the world and they do this and they move this and they do this and they do. You don't start off a serious, real conversation about the Jewish people that way because it already tweaks the optics of the narrative in a way that hides a bunch of actual real logical conversations that you could be having. You approach that with a real topic with a conspiracy theory starting off.
And it invites hysteria and
you lost.
If you're buying into a conspiracy theory, probably evidence has very little to do with any of it. In fact, with a conspiracy theory, the less evidence means, oh, they're really good at covering up. Look at that. The lack of evidence. There could be no greater evidence. And it's like, oh, jeez.
It's true. You could just prove.
All right. So that's the opposite of a conversation as far as I would like to ever have a conversation.
Right. That was something that was really wild as well, right? Because when Nick's podcast got taken away from him, there were a lot of far right people who were backing him up like they did with Alex Jones. Okay, so, well, you got some new followers now, I guess. All right, they kind of like the stuff you were saying about the Jews. They kind of like that. You got some new followers now. You know, it's the type of world now that we need people to give fact-based examples backed by evidence and so we need. It's almost like you need a statement to cover that statement for every statement that you make because there's always somebody who's going to pull out a board and have red tacks and tie string around the board and try to, you know what I mean? And try to say, oh, well, this is what he was really trying to say. And that's so weird to me that this is where we are now, right? Like this is where we are now.
I mean, it's kind of inevitable with the internet in which the lunatics can now find each other. But the shocking and surprising thing is how many lunatics there are, you know, like this has always been part of American culture as far as I've seen in my short 49 years, I haven't seen them this organized before. There was a Trump demonstration on a street corner in which near my house where the people were so excited And they're like carrying 5 or 6 flags across the crosswalk and dancing. And the guy had a megaphone and he said, Donald Trump is the greatest president who has ever lived in my lifetime. And I just remember, you know, like if I could only map your mind, sir, I would really love to see how that math played out and what metrics you're using, unless it's the conspiracy one in which the evidence that Donald Trump has done so much bad is really just proving how hard he's working at defeating the deep state from its pedophilia ring. Meanwhile, he's actually had positive relationships with people who have run actual sex trafficking schemes with minors.
Exactly.
Let's talk about you a little more in that, one, as someone who's writing for a journalistic audience, right, you have a lot of unique experiences, right? You served in the Navy and you have experienced PTSD. You've experienced homelessness and you also had contracted COVID-19 in the worst place, maybe, and the worst time to get COVID-19.
Yeah.
And you had to deal with that in New York. So I remember I saw Toni Morrison speak and someone asked her a question about gaining life experience and the kind of nature of it was, should I really overreach and try and do as many wild things as I can? And Toni Morrison said, oh dear, don't. Like, life will be hard for you no matter what you do. Don't try and make it harder than it's going to be. But it seems like for a lot of the really negative experiences you've had, you know, and living in poverty at times, that in some ways it, you know, like you probably, if you could go back and trade places, you might, but having these experiences does give you a lot of great perspectives from which to write.
That is
I'm guessing you would choose, let me live a better life and I'll write fiction. But that's not an option we're given.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, okay. So, like, if I could just be Stephen King for like three years and write 27 books. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Just the 3 years when he had the accident, when he got run over.
No. But he's just so prolific. I don't know how the hell he does that. It's so prolific. I would agree that having a lot of experience definitely helps write a lot of stuff. There's always the baggage that you have to deal with.
you have to have healed some, or at least, it can't be raw. Otherwise, what are you going to write? Like, what the fuck with pop? Fuck! Like, okay, that's a comedian might get away with that, but yeah, no, you can't be an essay writer and just go fucking shit, man. I mean, what?
That's true.
As a teacher of storytelling, I make my students declare they will not write autobiographical work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's not completely fair, but I need them to have processed and be on the other side of whatever it is they're going to write about so that I'm not criticizing the tragedies of their life because they're just delivering it raw.
Right. Exactly. It's such a completely different mindset to take a position to take when you live with an illness or you live with a lot of death, you've dealt with a lot of death, and you haven't taken time to really process it and grieve properly. I know for a fact that when I can't distance myself enough from a really traumatic event, I just can't write. I can't do it. I have to get that space, like you said. I have to get that space away from it so that eventually you can come back and you can talk about the thing, but you won't instantly harm your mental health even more by rehashing a thing that you haven't fully processed. And, you know, even then, if you have childhood traumas, I know the people who somehow manage to write about these really traumatic childhood experiences, and they do it just fine. But me thinking about it, I'm like, good God, I'd be on the floor right now just bawling my eyes out. I don't know how you do it. I can't. I have to have some kind of space between that experience. Unless, of course, when I had COVID, it was a little easier for me to write about that right after it happened because I felt like I was getting better by getting over it, by healing from it, because some people have died from it. Two of my friends died from it, and, you know, I know a bunch of other people. I don't think there's anybody I know personally who hasn't lost somebody to COVID. That's how bad it has been in New York.
Yeah.
And so I think it was a lot easier for me to write about it. One thing is because of how many people share that experience. I think if it's one of those things where just a few people know really where you're coming from, it's a little bit harder to write about it. It's a lot harder to write about it.
Well, and as we're still learning what its effects are and what it means, you know, because it's like, oh, I had a cold and now it's gone, or I will never breathe right again. Like the, or I'm dead, which like the varieties of how this affects people is just, it's a difficult thing to grapple with, which is why I perhaps so many people think that it's not real, or that because of the chaos of what we know about it, some people think there's no point in trying. I think we finally bullied them into at least putting on their fucking masks. But
I can understand that people with COVID-19 are hoax, or at least say, well, it's not that bad. It's not as bad as they're saying it. I really do want to know what they would have said during, like, the polio virus, right? What were people saying back then? What were people saying when polio virus came around and kids were losing control over their legs and such? You know, were people still... No. I won't even use that as an example. I'll use today's people and bring back the polio virus without the vaccine and everything. Because people... I think people are getting equally as smart as they are getting dumb.
There's a blossoming in either direction.
As years go by, it's like it's, I don't know. I really don't get it because there's more information out there. There's more, and then there's but then there's more disinformation too. So I guess. But
well, there's the problem of the sense of balance in the media. And most journalists lean liberal if they're not, you know, like diehard liberals. And when conservatives hear that, what they're hearing is that's how many journalists are biased, which means they really haven't spent much time around liberals, because liberals will argue until the wee hours of the morning about shit that doesn't matter or shit that does matter. But they will bend over backwards to try and accommodate a sense of fairness, which is how so many liberals today are basically, they're either centrist or kind of right wing. And then the right wing just moves so far to the right. And they're looking at the centrists going, oh my God, those are socialists. They want to destroy America. And it's like, because and there are liberal outlets where, no, that's just their point of view and everything's going to have that slant. But that's the accusation being leveled at the Times, which employs its share of conservatives and CNN. And as liberals, we're so in love with the idea of fairness that we're willing to sacrifice fairness so that people on the right can feel like they are being treated fairly. And then they will still declare that the center is so disgustingly left that they just hate America.
That's such a really ridiculous premise to take. I wasn't alive in the 60s or the 50s or the 40s. I wasn't alive during these time periods, right?
Yeah.
But people are so afraid of communism. You might as well just bring McCarthyism back. You know what I mean? You might as well, because they would fit right the fuck in with the House Un-American Activities Committee. Like, these people now, right? That's what's really blowing my fucking mind, because if your mindset is 60 years old, right? Your way of thinking is 60 years old, and you're still calling out people and calling them communists. Just, you know what I'm saying? You live in an America that should not exist anymore. That should not exist anymore. I've heard so many people call Black Lives Matter a communist organization.
Or a terrorist organization.
Terrorist. Yeah, and I'm like,
yeah, because all the bombs the shootings, except there are none, but that doesn't matter. That actually proves that there are terrorists. Okay.
Right. If that's how it works, then fuck it. Let's just lock up all of the red hat guys running around, right? Because, I mean, they're all terrorists. I know, because I just said it. So it's got to be true. It must be. There's a bigger case that can be made for them being actual terrorists, since guys who wear red hats have actually murdered people across America on many occasions in the past 5 years. It's like, okay. But the whole idea that these guys would fit right in with 50s America, you know, that should be a lot more troubling than it is. People are just like, oh yeah, there's these nut jobs over here who think that everything's communist. Oh well, whatever. I think that's scarier than the actual threat of communism in America. The knowledge that there are people born in the 90s who call everything they disagree with communism and recite Jordan Peterson religiously, you know.
Some of them switch it up to socialism, which doesn't quite have the stink that communism has, but but it's the neighbor, right, to communism.
Like they can tell the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, your COVID experience?
It's pretty straightforward. I started having a cough.
When was this?
This was right when it hit in March here in Harlem. And I started coughing. I told my doorman downstairs, I was like, hey, listen, I think I have the COVID and I'm going to die. So just know I told you this. Because I was being, I'm going to die probably. He said, go to the hospital. He said, call the ambulance or go to the hospital or something stupid. The hospitals weren't taking, first off, the beds were full. The paramedics weren't responding to people younger than a certain age. So I was like, yeah, all right, whatever.
So you're old enough to die, and not young enough to get in the line to get inside.
Yeah. So yeah, shortness of breath. I couldn't really sleep. But, you know, sweating. Body aches and stuff. And that lasted for about 2 weeks. And then I get better. And like for a week, I was just feeling great. I felt so awesome. And then the next 2 weeks was when I really had it. I mean, I couldn't understand then at the time, but from what I gather, it can come in cycles. It can come in waves. The last 2 weeks of having COVID was just the worst. I wanted to jump out a window. I really did. I couldn't sleep, but I was constantly exhausted. If I did fall asleep, I would wake up in panic mode and hardly able to breathe. I don't know how many times I thought I was just going to die in my sleep.
So did you not get any medical care?
Well, I found out that I had it, which I already knew. Like, I got the test, and then I got super sick. And then, no, I just went through the whole being sick and being afraid for my life, just really being terrified.
So, but
it doesn't discriminate as much as people.
But
you know what I mean?
It does, but you tried to go to the hospital?
I tried to go to the hospital. I tried to go to...
So you think you're probably dying. You go to the hospital and it's like, you probably had to...
No. I couldn't go to the hospital. They wouldn't take me to the hospital.
Who wouldn't take you to the hospital? An ambulance?
The paramedics.
Okay.
I called the paramedics. And they said, yeah, when they said, they came and they were like, you're faking. There's nothing wrong with you. So they left.
What the fuck?
So was...
Right, what's my next move?
They brought the gurney and everything, and they're like, we need you to walk down the stairs. I'm like, okay. So they were going to have me walk down to the front of the building and get into the, I don't know. I mean, I'm not even sure they were going to put me in the paramedics. I mean, I'm not even sure they were going to put me in there to take me to the hospital because they wanted me to walk. So they just left. I was like, you know what? If this is how it's going to be, you guys might as well just leave me here. I can't deal with this. If this is what it's going to be when I get to the hospital, I'm good.
I could receive no care more easily from home than I can all the way over there.
Yeah. So for a long time, I was just like, well, you know, it's okay if I die, because at least hopefully they're taking care of an old woman.
Yeah, who wouldn't have had the stamina.
Well,
of course, it was no guarantee that you had the stamina. But
exactly. I wasn't thinking about that logic because I just didn't care. I was just like, you know, if this is what it's going to be like, this is what New York has to offer us. Okay, well, I'm better off dying here than screw it. But, you know, I got over it.
The hospital's filled with sick people.
Filled with sick people. Yeah. And I got over it. That's how it is. It was just 4 weeks of hell.
Except for that one vacation week in the middle.
By 1 week. Yeah, like interrupted by 1 week, which, you know, it was like, you know.
So how is it that your output generally goes to newspapers rather than literary magazines and that? I imagine plenty of writers would make that choice if they knew how to.
Well, I'm very fortunate because I happen to know a fair amount of editors from years of working with newspapers and other periodicals. So I know names and I know email addresses and such. And so I just been very fortunate to have worked at this long enough and had people believe in me. That's basically what it was. I've convinced people to put trust in me. I don't think I would have done it if it wasn't for their faith in me. I very much doubt that I could have written for as many people as I have written.
And once you get the approval of some people, that gains the attention of some of the other people who recognize that you're a thing. It also helps if the writing's strong.
You know, that's always a good
thing. In the writing world, I haven't seen much nepotism involving bad writing. It's more along the lines of, it does help if you know people who will take a look, but it also has to be great when they take a look.
Exactly. And that's another thing too, is just, I mean, I have made contacts with editors I never worked with before, just based off of approaching them with a good idea of something to write about. I feel like if that's the case, if you just pitch an editor out the blue, it's fine that you've been published in all these places. That's fine. But it doesn't mean a damn thing if your writing isn't on point. So often, if I'm just pitching some editor I've never met, I won't even say where I've written. I won't even do that. I just talk about the idea. I have the pitch. And then they like it or they leave. That has worked pretty well for me because editors have so... They don't have a lot of time to see your whole fucking resume. You know what I mean? Yeah. The most important thing is that you get the message to them. You get the message to them, get the point across, and then let them run with it. I think that's where a lot of people who try to break in, they try too hard. They try to really oversell whatever it is they're trying to write about. And that really turns off a lot of editors.
And the pitch has to be timely and interesting to an editor. Like, I'll be excited to see this piece in. If it sounds as good as what's being pitched, if they struggle to find a pitch, then goodbye, you're out.
Exactly. That's a skill in itself. Determining what it is you're writing about and if you are the person who should be writing about it. I have written pieces before and I knew what I was talking about. But it was just trash. So I didn't get it published. There have been instances where, you know, the idea was good, but the execution wasn't there. Or it was just the wrong editor. Some editors are less flexible. We'll say that. They're less flexible than others.
Well, an editor has a vision for the whole paper, right? Or the whole magazine. And they've got other pitches you don't know about. So, and they're bombarded by pitches. I mean, I have a lowly podcast and people keep pitching me authors, a lot of publicity people, and it's clear they haven't listened to my show. I have long form conversations and they're like, oh, this author should be on your show. They could talk about these topics. And I'm like, what book did they write? And why should I read it? And why should my listeners be excited about it? Those are the things that matter. Like, I don't care if this person is a life coach. I don't care that there's a list of journalistic topics that, you know, we could put on a list. It's more, am I going to get really excited about this book they've written recently? That's all it takes. But if that's like item number 10 on their agenda, it's like, well, I've got room for maybe two things on your agenda for me. So
I know that it's hard to say no to people. I think, like, if you're a reasonable human being, I think it's hard to say no to people. But I also think there are a lot of people who make it easy for you to say no. I think so. They make it easy for you.
Well, when an author makes a pitch to be on my show, it's harder for me to say no than when a publicity person who seems to not really care about writing is pitching an author.
Right. Right.
Yeah, and so I do, even if the author's not really my cup of tea and I don't like the work, harder for me to say no to fellow writers, even if I kind of don't dig what they're doing, which isn't necessarily, you know, a knock against what they do. It's just I have taste.
Yeah.
Not good taste, just taste.
Yeah. You have respect enough for yourself and your show to know what it is you're looking for, what you want, and what works well for you. I mean, if, for instance, let's just say that Ben Shapiro wanted to be on the show.
That's a hard no.
Well, you know, talking about his wife's sandy vagina. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you probably wouldn't want to talk with that guy.
Right? No. Probably like, not. If I were a lot probably younger, I may have thought that was interesting. But, you know, dyed-in-the-wool conservatives, I used to love P.J. O'Rourke, and then he just kind of looked off into the middle distance during the George W. Bush administration. Like, this is supposed to be my side. I'm going to pretend like there's not really a political conversation to be had right now. I understand why you would have to do that, but I found it kind of disappointing. So that contrarian spirit, like, no, I will talk to conservatives. Like, I can't say never, but I will say, yeah, there's like a less than 1% chance that's going to happen on my show.
I would imagine that would be very difficult if you're like me and think that Ben Shapiro is too much. That's what I'll say.
He's not good. Like, and his arguments are not good faith arguments. So,
exactly.
Like I love the idea of actually having a real live conversation in old-fashioned argument with conservatives, but no, this is about swinging dicks and winning, and it's like, yeah, I don't know. That's
right. Yeah. It's something I find about so many conservative hosts and writers, when they do have, so they'll win, quotation mark, they'll win these arguments with people who just want to have actual arguments. These guys, it's more like, okay, can you throw a football through a goalpost on a runaway train? If you can do that, then you can argue with me. You know what I mean? It's such a pissing contest.
Yeah.
And what I find is that a lot of these guys, they'll make it seem like you don't understand what they're talking about, but it's just that they didn't explain what they were saying well enough for you to repeat exactly what it was that they were saying.
Well, and a lot of them,
so they just get away with it.
And a lot of them talk really fast, so that you're trying to, like, well, that sounded wrong, but then they just said two more things while you're trying to track that.
Exactly.
So that you're trying to come up with an argument, but they're going to win because they're just going to speed talk over you.
Yeah. If you repeat back to them what they just said, they'll be like, no, that's not what I meant. No, it's not. No. Do you listen? You know, it would be a bad day. It would really be a bad day.
Well, and I don't think it was necessarily good when, like, William F. Buckley would have radicals on a show. Yeah. Jack Kerouac.
Yeah.
There's a circus element to that that's certainly interesting.
Yeah.
But it's not really great discourse.
You know, it feels like it gets old way too fast. That's what it feels like. I haven't done it recently, but when I look at or listen to or read about this course that a pundit, writer, host of a far-right show or book has, I get tired of it so fast. I'm just done with it, like, so fast. I have so little patience with the techniques that they use and how they badger the person who they're supposed to be arguing with. I mean, that's not how, you know, to ask like three questions before one of them has been answered. It's not how you do it. You don't do that. imagine going to somebody's family dinner and just say, how long have you been married? When did you get married? How long do you plan on staying married? When are you going to die?
Come Why are you on. So dishonest? You're not answering my questions. Yeah.
Exactly. Right? That's good.
So when were you in grad school? Right? Because you're right behind, like a block or two behind where I went to grad school. Right? Because you're at the new school.
Oh, I went to the new school. I started grad school in 2014, and I left before I finished. So I have about a year left. I'm not proud about it, but it happened.
Well, if you're getting paid to be doing your writing, then yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing.
To be sitting
in
a classroom may not be the most essential way to spend your time.
I wasn't making any money. I'm doing this thing. I wasn't writing. I was writing for the class, of course. So I wasn't getting my own writing out there. And so I was all stressed out and I was all upset and worried about where I was going to live because I wouldn't make any money. I wasn't working. So, yeah.
Oh. New York is stressful real estate wise. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Now, if I got that job at Chipotle, I might still be living in New York.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Definitely. Right.
So what was the new school like for you?
It was great. I really enjoyed the new school. The professors, earlier today I was reading through some of the things that I did in some of my classes. I really was lucky to have the people who trained me, because the new school has so many literary superstars. It's insane. Anne Hood and Honor Moore and Sid Offit, just really outstanding people. Sue Shapiro, my mentor, just really outstanding people who know their craft, love it, they do it well, and they want you to get the best out of the experience. And I really got that. I really felt like I got that when I went there. On top of all of the academic stuff, there was always the parties, too. Those were awesome, right? The parties. But the parties with the wine and cheese, they had Jamaica Kincaid and Juno Diaz.
I think
Diaz,
you mean readings, right? But you're just not emphasizing the readings?
Sure. There were the readings. Sure. During Penn Week, they would always have.
Oh, right. Okay.
They would have readings. Like they would have readings. They'd have Q&As, and then they'd have parties. They'd have like actual.
Gotcha.
Not like party, but you know,
a writer's party.
Yeah, there's wine, and then there's cheese here, and you can get drunk and fart. And, you know, whatever. But yeah, when I accidentally got into an elevator with Salman Rushdie, like it was awkward because not that he did anything wrong. He didn't do anything wrong. He was trying to get to this dinner that he was doing. And I'm looking at him like, wow, oh my God. You know, just bug-eyed looking at him like, And I don't know. I think maybe he didn't like that because it was so awkward. It was just very awkward. I'm glad I didn't say anything because I probably would have screwed it up and he'd never forgive me if I ever meet him again.
You know, I'm sure that happens almost every day for him. And because you didn't force it to be prolonged awkwardness.
Yeah, that's true. He had some kind of dinner that he was doing. It was $1,000 a plate. You know how these things go, you know.
No, I don't, but that's all right.
Yeah, me either. I've never been to it, so I was just
At NYU, I think it was once a month in the spring, although maybe it was both semesters, we had emerging writers reading series in which we would basically hire a ringer who already lived in New York to be the host, and we would have dinner at the writer's house.
Oh, wow.
We had a brownstone on West 14th, I think. And 58. I can't believe, I forgot the address. I used to know it by heart. Anyway, so in the basement, we would have dinner with the author That was one of those experiences, which is like, oh, I'm actually having dinner with this writer I admire so much. So I got to eat with Amy Hempel. And then I think I talked my way into dinner with Gary Steinkart.
That's awesome. That is awesome. Holy crap.
But it was so much fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, like that's probably their, you know, like they're singing for their supper. They get paid to do this appearance and they got to be nice to graduate students who are going to fawn over them a little bit. But there were also real conversations. Anyway, I think I'm blathering.
No, that's fine. I totally understand.
Well, when I went to the New School for events, I always felt like I was playing hooky. Like, I know it's open to the public, but I feel like I'm so spoiled at NYU. Yeah. Like, maybe I shouldn't be going to other schools, but I can't help it. If they're going to let me in and hang out with this person or see this, then I'm definitely going.
It's funny because NYU is buying up so much. NYU is pulling a Columbia and just buying up every damn thing. They took one of the New School's buildings, if I'm not mistaken. If I'm not mistaken, they did. But, man, that's the way things go, I guess. You know, it's just college is college and money is money. And, you know, it's...
Well, we were...
It is what it is.
So the address is 58 West 10th Street in the West Village. And it was just a brownstone. So Lillian Vernon bought us a brownstone for a creative writing program.
Yeah.
And so I got to feel like a rich person as a student and then get my ass on a train back to Brooklyn, which is pretty cool, except in the summertime when, there's just no way to get the apartment cool enough.
Everything is a chore in the summertime. It's always just a chore. I mean, but I really did enjoy my time at the New School and all of the events and the people. And I really, really enjoyed it. I had a great time.
Well, that's the show this week. I'd like to thank Alex Miller and Scribophile. If you like this show, please review it over on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're grabbing this from. Oh, and consider buying Guy Psycho and the Ziggurat of Shame, my debut novel, which is really good. Also, don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including The Diaries of a Sawzalt Scribbler, as transcribed by Dimitri Cockney, Comics Are Trying to Break Your Heart by Drew Barth, and The Curator of Schlock by Jeff Schuster. All right, gang. Until next week, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
For more information and updates about this podcast, friend us on Facebook at The Drunken Odyssey with John King. See our website at thedrunkenodyssey.com or email us at thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
Dear listeners, this is your friend, Chris Booth. If you have enjoyed this program, which comes to you absolutely free, and are wondering what you might do to support this show, please, please, please write a review of the podcast on iTunes, comment on the website, and most of all, tell your friends. If you buy books online, please click on the Powell's link on the left-hand side of the website. Doing so will grant this show a small commission on anything you purchase, at no expense at all to you, and help support both a wonderful podcast and a wonderful brick-and-mortar independent bookstore in Portland, Oregon. If you must use the services of the metastasizing mega-corporate empire Amazon.com, then there is a similar link to Amazon further down the page on the left-hand side. You fiends. Thank you for listening. I will now resume drinking. Ever yours, Christopher.
Sailor Jerry, only you understand.
A while back, John King endowed the Museum of Schlock and tasked me, Jeff Schuster, with curating the bugger. Each week, I curate one more entry into this proud genre of film. I think... Truth is, I'm really not sure what schlock is, but my writing about it is sublime. Read it every Friday at thedrunkenodyssey.com.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.